It's the bad guy in every episode.
Yeah.
M. Night Shyamalan did not write this podcast. The twist is the same every time. And you always see it coming.
Who are the writers of Scooby-Doo? Because that's who wrote this podcast.
Yeah, Hanna-Barbera wrote this.
There you go. Doomsday, Renfro.
Happy Doomsday, Lauren. How's it going?
It's cloudy and America sucks. So I say level 7 doom.
Wow, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
It actually feels wonderful here today.
Oh,
but,
great.
But yeah, I'm having a lot of late night spiraling lately. I was just saying to you before we started recording, I think I've gone from a place of in and out of dissociating with current events to actively trying to dissociate on purpose,
mm-hmm.
because we are living in a very scary cartoon.
Interesting. Okay. Do we think that actively trying to dissociate versus just automatic dissociation is better? I feel like it might be.
See, I don't know how to do it, but if I could control my own brainwashing into thinking I'm living in a normal reality, that I'd like to sign up for that.
The reason why I'm saying that is because, like, if you know that you're dissociating, right? Like, you're actively trying to dissociate, that means you've not become desensitized to the insanity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Versus people who are just automatically dissociating without consciousness, I feel like they are just far gone. I feel like that is a person who's going to be ineffective in any productivity toward dismantling anything.
Look, I'm a Manchurian candidate, okay? I'm dissociating until you say the trigger word, and then I'm in the streets, okay? That's how I want to do it.
That is an amazing analogy. That was so good.
Yeah.
You just have these stores of film knowledge in your heads, just
it's my
moments like that.
Point of reference for all life experience is some kind of movie.
Art does imitate life, so that tracks.
Well, anything fun going on?
No, that's the problem. The happy and doomsday is not going very well.
Yeah.
Every day, there's an onslaught of stupidity. Mm. Oh, actually, no, there is happy.
Oh, good.
There is happy. Tesla stock is tanking.
Oh, I love
it. I love that.
Yeah.
And Trump got hit in the face with a boom mic.
That's so funny. Oh. If we all haven't wanted to shove something phallic in that guy's face, you know?
We need more shoe throwing. Remember shoe throwing?
Yeah. That guy threw a shoe at George Bush.
Man, what an icon.
We're all wearing shoes at all times and we almost never throw them at people. Let's bring that back. Make America throw shoes again.
That was iconic.
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 We should have a statue to that man in Washington, D.C.
Who was that man?
I don't know. My personal hero, and yet I don't know his name.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, we need to bring shoe throwing back. People always say boo, tomato, but there actually needs to be tomatoes again.
Yeah.
Don't just say it, boo, tomato. Throw the goddamn tomato.
It's more practical. Like a pie, you got to be careful because it can kind of fall apart. It's hard to keep in your trench coat. Tomatoes.
It could be a snack. You could have it in your lunch box, right?
Uh-huh. You could say, this is tomatoes for my family, you know?
Yeah.
Like people do with the soup cans.
And just lob it straight into the frontal lobe.
Yeah.
That would be awesome.
Also, who can get that mad? It's so vaudeville, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you punched him. I want to throw a tomato at him and then take one of those really long canes and pull him off stage.
And pull him off stage. Yeah. We need more of that. We need more of that. But that is the happy.
That's the happy, yeah.
Is Tesla stock tanking?
You know, because I'm really good at managing my mental health. I woke up and immediately watched a 40-minute long video about Tesla. And a fun thing that I was seeing this the guy in this video was talking about was that not only is Tesla's stock cratering because of everything he's saying, but Tesla has been absurdly overvalued for so long that it's like doubling in on itself. Tesla stock is as high as it is, largely because of the promises that Elon makes. And even outside of all the Nazi stuff, investors are starting to be like, okay, every single year he promises to us that this thing is going to happen by next year with self-driving cars and all these other promises that never come true. He's been doing it for a decade now. Like, oh, he's just lying. Even if none of this was happening, slowly people would go, 90% of this valuation shouldn't be happening. It should be worth like a tenth what it is just on its own merits. But they got to kick him out and put a CEO people like. I think they should take out Elon Musk. Fuck Tesla. I don't care. But if I were on the board, I would kick off Elon as CEO, vote him out, and I bring in Weird Al Yankovic.
Oh.
And boom, Tesla sales through the roof.
Whoa.
It's all a personality driven thing anyways, right? They barely advertise because Musk is like, I'll just make myself like a Steve Jobs figure and then that will sell cars. And for the most part, he's been right. But when you do that and your entire brand is built around a person's personality and then people don't like that personality, brings the whole fucking brand down.
Yeah.
There's no personality brand behind Ford or Honda. Who's the CEO of that? I don't fucking know.
What? Okay. How did we get to a place where Elon was considered a genius? Genuine question.
Well, he goes out on a stage and tells people he's a genius. Mm. And then we all believed him. When he bought Tesla, the two guys who founded Tesla, he made a deal with them that he was allowed to call himself a founder, even though he wasn't a founder.
Mm.
So he's just like, I think he's somebody who saw Steve Jobs and said, I can do that own myth making and that will make me money. And he was right.
He was right. So he's just a personality.
Yeah, he's just like Trump. He's just
I have done no work into learning who this man is. I have not liked him since the day I saw his face. I, in fact, did judge that very disturbing looking book by its cover. And I never drank the Kool-Aid, not even once. I saw him once and I was like, don't like it. Moving on.
I appreciate that. I, at least in his early days, did buy into it because, it's like EVs and rockets. That's cool. Making futuristic cars and futuristic rockets. And he's kind of weird and meek and quiet.
No. He's too weird. He looks weird. I never bought into it. But also, I think because I pay attention to like China and Japan a lot, they were doing so much cool stuff. So to me, he wasn't doing anything that I hadn't seen in the Asian market. I'm going to put it out there. I very specifically was skeptical of him, not only because of how he looks, which is very strange, but also because he's South African. And I just knowing that he came from wealth, I was like, I don't like this guy. I don't know his story yet, but I don't like him and I'm not going to look into him. And look at me being correct.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I could have called it. I didn't know that much about. I think most of us didn't know that much about him for a while. I don't think it was until he called that guy a pedophile, the cave diver, that everybody was like, what?
Wait, what? What are you talking about?
You remember that story?
No.
You gotta look into your Elon stuff. Remember when all those kids were stuck in that cave?
I don't
got
it. I don't want to look into any Elon stuff. I'm going to take exactly what you say, and that's going to be what it is.
Okay, well, there was a bunch of kids, like this children's soccer team got stuck in this cave in like Brazil or somewhere. Mm-hmm. I don't remember where. And then there's a big national story. Ron Howard made a movie about it.
Oh, yeah. I do remember this. But I don't remember anything about him, Elon.
So Elon was like, I'm going to build a special submarine to get him out. And they were like, no, we're going to do our own thing with divers. And then he was like, you're a pedophile to the guy that was leading, the guy that actually saved the kids. He called a pedophile. I guess because he really wanted to get in there and save those kids, which made him a pedophile. Just completely weird, baseless, massive accusation. That was kind of for a lot of people, probably for me too, was the first, like, I might have gotten inklings that he was a little weird before that. But that's where I was like, oh, this guy's a weird piece of shit, actually.
Well, I felt he looked like a weird piece of shit. And that is why I never looked into him.
You know, controversial, but we were just saying in our pre-record chat that you actually can judge a book by its cover. In many cases, specifically we're talking about Gavin Newsom. Always looked like a slimy weatherman.
Yeah.
And then you look at his recent developments in his podcast. oh, he's a slimy two-faced piece of shit.
Yeah.
Sometimes our little caveman instincts are correct and sometimes they're not correct.
Sometimes they're correct. My hope, because the other thing too, I don't even like the name Elon. It feels very otherworldly in a bad way.
It's better than names of his kids.
Yeah, yeah. I don't even know the names of his kids. They're like math problems.
Yes. Yeah, like XAG4.
Yeah.
Something. They're like characters I don't even know how to find on a keyboard.
Yeah. My hope is that he turns into, what's the billionaire of the submersible?
Oh, yeah. I don't remember his name off the top of my head. I've seen people saying that on TikTok where they're making these like joke posts to go, hey, Trump, did you know no US president has ever been to space? Elon makes rockets.
Yeah.
You should go to space.
Make it a competition. But
yeah. Try it out.
But I keep hoping that he'll turn into that where he like, because the billionaire was like talking it up and like really getting people on his side and like really making the submersible idea and visiting the Titanic a great idea, even though it was crazy risky. And like, we're breaking things. We're trying things new. We're trying new things. And we don't have to go by the same guidelines as decades, centuries old nautical knowledge has taught us. Like, we could do things differently.
Yeah.
And then now he's basically plasma in the ocean. My hope is that Elon lives to see that day.
Yeah, that would be great.
But the space version. That'd be awesome.
Cool. It'd be fun if he goes out like fireworks. It's
oh my God.
Celebration. Imagine if when you die, you were fireworks. It's like a celebration.
It's a huge
instantaneous celebration.
Instantaneous. I mean, sure, it would absolutely disrupt flight patterns, just like the last explosion of a SpaceX
crafted. This one would be worth it. I think everybody would see that their flights are delayed and go, oh, well, that's okay. That's okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Delay it more if you want.
I don't have to leave today at all, anymore. Actually. Like,
yeah.
I can leave next week. My days are flexible. That's some happy, actually. I started pretty in doom zone, but now I'm like at a level, I'm like at a level 8 happy.
Nice. Yeah. It's a dark way of finding happiness, but hey, that's what we deal with on this show.
You got to take it where you can.
Yay.
But I've got some doom headed our way.
Okay.
On this particular topic, the episode titled, Oh No, Journalism? Did you know, first question up, did you know that I am a non-practicing journalist?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
We know what they say. They say practice makes perfect.
Practice makes perfect. But seriously, it's what I studied. And it's honestly the direction I thought I'd go in before I realized I could have a visually creative career. I've been writing since I was a little girl, and then that's what I studied. So this one is actually near and dear to my heart. Yeah, I still deeply, deeply value the tenets of journalism, and I pretty much employ them throughout my life in some capacity, because I just like how we were taught to function, how we were taught to think, you know, critical thinking, things that are lacking in today's world. But I deeply, deeply, deeply value journalistic principles, or the traditional journalistic principles. And so I wanted to bring this topic to the table because I am, let's say, perturbed about Jeff Bezos's actions now that he's the owner of the Washington Post. He's been the owner since 2013. And the Washington Post, which happens to be my hometown newspaper and also just a national and international paper, he has made some changes that I find to be extremely disturbing and a huge encroachment over journalistic integrity and democracy.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I needed to dark chat about it because it's only getting worse. And for someone who once said that he would not do very much, that he would be a hands-off owner, he sure has got his hands in it.
Sure has hands in it. He's even making a lot more public statements than I would have expected. It's not exactly slight.
He wrote an opinion in the Washington Post section about the things that he's looking to do. And I do encourage people to read it because if you've ever had any questions about his personality, I think it does a pretty good job of depicting who the Washington Post is dealing with. He makes no bones about it. Again, in an earlier episode, we said that this is the guy who goes into negotiation as if he's the lion going after a gazelle.
Oh, yeah.
So that same personality shows up in this opinion that he wrote in the Washington Post. I do want to get into the world of journalism in the United States as we know it today, and very specifically United States. I can't speak for global journalism. I'm an American. We're going to be talking about United States journalism.
Okay.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Are you ready?
I'm ready. I got my seatbelt on.
Before I get into this, though, where are you at? Where's your doom level at right now?
Specifically on what I think presently about journalism before you give me more details. Mm-hmm. 7 out of 10.
Dang.
I think you're going to bump it up, though. I'm going to assume you're going to bump it up.
You're going to go off the scale.
Oh, my God.
You're already at a 7. You have zero faith in journalism. Almost zero.
Nah, I don't have a lot. That's 7 out of 10 doom.
7 out of 10 doom. All right. 7 out of 10 doom.
Actually, maybe to expand, I think the current way I think about journalism is that there's so much bias and control across the board that you have to take all of it in, and also, unfortunately, diversify with a lot of takes, a lot of your majority reports and your little online shows, because they're way better at deciphering that bias than I am.
Yeah.
And you can't listen to one or two sources. You have to be a bit of a junkie to even get through all the bad faith shit. So that's currently how I think about journalism, is that there's so much bias that you have to take all of it in to even decipher where the bias is. And I rely on a handful of trusted people outside of the main power sphere to help me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you started with that, because I think a lot of this is going to open you up to what even trusting means in this current landscape, and what it has come to mean in journalism generally. It's very disturbing. Anyway, buckle up. So first, I want to give the framework of journalism and just specifically delve into the golden age of American journalism, because there's a whole history of journalism in general that mostly started with the elites, of giving news to the elites based on what's happening on the ground. But we're not going to get into that. That is well before our time. Let's just talk about the golden age of American journalism, which is roughly the 20th century, right?
Okay.
So at this time, we had icons like Joseph Pulitzer, right? Is beginning the and Hearst, William Randolph Hearst. Mm-hmm. And then their newspapers ended up shaping public opinion. For those people who don't know where Pulitzer comes from, like, it's as early as the 20th century, early 20th century, when the emergence of journalistic icons like Joseph Pulitzer came about.
I was gonna say William Randolph Hearst is what Citizen Kane is based on.
You're right. Oh, see. There you go again with the music, with the movie references.
And I've been to Hearst Castle. I've been to his.
Oh, home. Have you?
Yeah, it's bananas.
Castle.
It's a castle, all right.
Well, like I said, the golden age of journalism is in the early 20th century. We saw Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst come to prominence, and their papers are what shaped public opinion at that time, for the most part. You did have local papers and stuff like that for very, very localized news, which was extremely important. But in terms of national coverage and national understanding of what is America, we pretty much are looking at Pulitzer and Hearst. Mm-hmm. This era also brought about what we understand to be yellow journalism, which is your more sensationalized type of coverage. And it was mostly involving wars and conflicts and things like that, things that would get people to buy a paper, the newsboys and stuff. So for those people out there who think that we're sensationalized now, the groundwork was already set back when journalism and newspapers became something that you needed to buy in order to get the news, right? Mm-hmm. So at its best in the golden age, or at its peak, American journalism absolutely played a crucial role in the functioning of democracy. So much so that it was considered the fourth estate, because it was meant to be a watchdog and to check government and businesses.
What does that mean, fourth estate?
So the fourth estate represents one of the four pillars by which basically democracy operates. So there's the executive, legislative, judicial, and then there's free press.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. That's not what I was thinking.
Democracy has to function, or the idea is that democracy has to function with those four pillars, and that free press is an important one, that democracy will collapse without it. In fact, the Washington Post adopted a slogan like in 2017, which is democracy dies in darkness. And when I think about that slogan, I think about it as the fourth estate. And more than anything, though it was a part of the pillars, it was an independent force. It's an independent force, and it was meant to enforce, like not enforce, but meant to ensure accountability of the other four pillars of various businesses, things like that. And at the local level, even more so, because the local level was able to delve into more specific matters that impact the direct citizens of that area. So like your small town would have a paper and you would know that the bank is doing something in your area and how you can rail against it and things like that.
Right.
And at its best, right, and the national level, it helped to cover Watergate, expose the racist country during the civil rights movement, and educated Americans about the realities of the Vietnam War. So all of this is golden age American journalism. Like, they're not afraid to call truth to power. Mm-hmm. They're always in search of the truth. And it valued objectivity, accuracy, and independence. Okay. Yeah. I keep going back to that.
Yeah.
But the fourth estate concept came back maybe medieval times, because it was like the clergy, nobility, the people, and free press. So even back then, it was like press was important to how to function in a decent society. Even when you did have clergy and nobility at the top, it was still important to get the news out somehow.
That makes sense. Like, it'd almost be a fourth branch if only it weren't for the fact that being independent from the government's the whole point.
Right. But okay. I do think I'm going to blow that whole concept of being independent from the government out of the water for you. And I'm really sorry in advance.
Oh, boy. What are you going to tell me, like, Fox News is getting talking points? You're telling me MSNBC is getting talking points? I'm going to be shocked. I'm going to be shocked if you tell me that.
Then I will just let this unfold.
Okay, well, if you don't hear a response, it's because I'm on the other end, fainted.
Shocked.
Unconscious.
All right. When we were in school, when I was in school, we had pretty much a journalistic oath that included some ethics that I will list out.
Oh, this is like the journalism equivalent to the Hippocratic Oath?
Pretty much. And there are organizations that have put these together to ensure that it's always operating with the highest ethics. So much so that even when I was still in college, operating outside of the ethics code was detrimental to your entire career. Like, you'd never work again. If there was one ounce of you, or one instance, or a glimmer of an instance of you doing something against these ethics, you were done. You were never gonna, you had to go, I don't know, write novels or something. You could never be trusted as a source any longer.
Yeah.
And it was always seen as such a massive hit to the journalistic community, because if a person rose to such prominence and it came out that some of their stories, or like one of their stories, was plagiarized, then it started to sow seeds of doubt generally in the entire journalistic community. So they had to completely eradicate those people, and the punishments were harsh.
It's crazy how differently we thought about things back then. Mm-hmm. Can I put another movie reference in here?
Yeah.
There's gonna be a lot. There's already a lot swirling around I'm gonna bring up. You ever seen Broadcast News?
Mm-mm.
Movie Broadcast News, minor spoiler, one of the major points in the movie that like changes the audience's opinion around one of the big characters is that he's interviewing someone and he fake cries. Like, I can't really put something in his eyes.
Yeah.
Like, make a fake tear and give like an emotional punch to it. And in the movie, you're supposed to be like, oh my God, this guy's a fake. This guy's a phony. It's all sensationalism. And I think it's funny watching that now where it's like, that's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to the current media landscape. And it is sad how much that integrity, you know, whether or not that integrity was fully represented across the board, the public perception that that's how things should be, and then feeling very sincere and genuine, mm-hmm. that things need to be as objective and untied to bias as possible, it's another world.
Yeah.
It's from today.
Yeah. And it really, really deeply bothers me, because I studied this stuff, and like, we got fact check so regularly just on our in-class assignments of coverage that when things are being released now, and for the listener, this will be a two-part episode where we won't delve into the digital aspect of where we are now, but to look at where things are now, where things are just able to be released without being fact-checked, is so mind-boggling to me. I don't even know another word for that. It's so mind-boggling to me because the amount of times I had red ink over pieces that I've had to cover throughout my college career, and even when I was working at a newspaper, it's insane to me that things are just allowed to fly. The amount of misinformation that's just allowed to go unchecked, the amount of things that get published without being edited for correction. I remember writing an article about a spelling bee, right? And I had the wrong, I forgot what it was. It was like the wrong time. It was like 30
like
minutes.
Like of the event?
Yeah, time of the event. And I don't know how it happened, but it went through all the copy editing and everything. And then it was like, someone called the newspaper and said, you said that this was going to be on at this time. It's not on. And so then we looked and we're like, oh, holy crap. It's on in 30 minutes. It's supposed to be on in 30 minutes. So then we had to print a correction literally in the next paper that was coming out the next day, even after the event occurred.
Wow. Even though it's no longer relevant.
Yeah.
It's just a showtime event. Wow.
And so we had to apologize to the people who called in and say, sorry, it'll be on in 30 minutes. I got yelled at. Other people in the newsroom got yelled at for the incorrect time.
Wow.
I got yelled at not just by readers. I got yelled at by the editor.
Wow.
And then the copywriters got yelled at because they didn't catch it. And it's just, it was so intense that to be in this world where none of that is actually happening. In fact, it's the common acceptance that fact checking is not necessary is mind boggling to me. And I miss this innocence of you have to be, you have to operate under this code of ethics. I miss that.
It seems to me that today, even it's still even few and far between, but the only times that misinformation actually gets checked is when it threatens a company or corporate interest, like Fox News and the voting machines. It's the biggest, I think it's the biggest private settlement in media history by like a massive. It's because they just went on making all these conspiracy theories about what's the company, the voting machines?
I don't remember the company.
I forget the name of the, something that starts with a D, the voting machines. And they just lie after lie after lie. And you were able to, they were able to prove that they knew they were lying. And then, it was like an absurd sum they had to pay for that. But that's rare because most of their lies don't directly conflict with someone who can sue them.
Yeah.
Libel laws with media, I mean, media is given a little extra wiggle room, right? For, I think, understandable reasons. Sometimes you get things wrong. And
sometimes you get things wrong. And you have to prove intent when you're talking about libel and defamation. You have to prove intent, which is notoriously hard to prove. But under this administration, they're wanting to loosen all that up anyway. So, yeah, should be interesting.
Should be interesting.
Should be interesting. But let me just give you a taste of the ethical. Well, let me just read all of the ethical codes in journalism that I had to abide by and that it should be. We should be abiding by for the most trusted outlets. One.
Ten commandments of journalism.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there are eight. So accuracy and fairness, self-explanatory. Independence and impartiality. This was a huge one. You are not to be swayed. You're not on anyone's side. You're simply on the observer and the reporter side, period.
Right.
You're not looking to move a story in any one direction. I have a cool story about this, actually. I remember covering this one story, a very silly story that happened on campus of somebody being kicked out, kicked off of campus because one, they were already graduated, and two, they were trying to do something that had already been ruled that he wasn't allowed to do. And I was an editor on our school paper at the time. And everyone else had a bias about this person who had been kicked off campus because this person was popular. And I didn't give a crap about who this person was. I didn't even know him, right? And so I'm like, no one can write this because all of you have your feelings about what happened. Either some of you hate him because he's popular, or some of you, you know, love him because he's popular. None of, I don't even know this person. So I'm just going to write the story. I interviewed all the sides and I just simply reported what happened. My partner at the time was so angry at the article because I did not have any bias whatsoever. I simply reported what happened.
Yeah.
Just to let people know, hey, this is the series of events. And the interview that I did with the guy, I also interviewed him, was almost entirely his feelings. And so when I asked him very pointed questions about, okay, but what happened? Were you told this? Were you told that? And the answers were yes, 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 yes. And so it sounds like we're just upset that though he broke the rules, you guys felt like the kicking out was a bit extreme.
Right.
Got it. But he did break the rules. And this is what happened as a result. Anyway, I got so much backlash for that article. But I illustrate that to say that I was an independent and impartial reporter about this series of events. And that is such an important part. You're not meant to be bought by anything or anyone.
Yeah. I think the story also illustrates the other side of this, which is that people want the media to reinforce the narrative they already have in their head. They kind of, as much as we idealistically say we want impartiality, a lot of people don't want impartiality.
No, they don't want it. In fact, my partner at the time was like, I'm going to publish an article. And I'm just like, oh, counter article. I'm like, I am literally the editor of the paper. I'm not going to let you. I'm not going to let you post a very biased article because this guy's your friend. This is insane. I didn't even know you guys were friends. Anyway, that didn't last. We were against each other journalistically.
Yeah.
Anyway, so accuracy and fairness, independence and impartiality, accountability goes back to my spelling bee story. I was wrong. Here's the correction.
Yes.
Transparency. We're meant to disclose our sources. Mm-hmm. And how we're obtaining the information. Just we're meant to disclose our sources. Mm-hmm. If they like, I want to say this distinction. So we're meant to disclose our sources. And I know there's a lot of stuff out there where people don't disclose their sources. If a person you're interviewing is important to the story, but wants to remain anonymous, you're meant to disclose that to the reader or the listener. You're not meant to just say whatever you want and not say who the source is. You're meant to say the source for this chose to remain anonymous, which is why a lot of times you'll see a source close to such and such said this.
Yeah.
But you're meant to let it be known that this source has decided to remain anonymous. Mm-hmm. And then the transparency also is meant to make sure that you're not bribing anybody to give you information. You're supposed to tell people how you got the info. Mm-hmm. Number 5, respect for privacy. What do you think of when you hear that?
I think of like the tabloids, TMZ, not maybe prying yourself too far into people's personal lives. Is that what it's going for?
Yeah, that's what it's going for. So it's like,
don't put a camera in someone's bedroom window.
Yeah, you don't do stuff like that. And I don't consider TMZ to be journalism, but whatever. It's respecting a person's rights to privacy. Mm-hmm. It's not publishing names just for the exposing of the person, just to get the sensationalized aspect of the story. This is huge in today's journalistic landscape because no one respects anybody's privacy. What does privacy even mean in this world that we have? When walking down the street, you can find yourself in the back of someone's TikTok video. Mm-hmm. What does privacy mean? But once upon a time, we had to balance the public's right to know with the individual's right to privacy. And I think we're constantly battling that, but like, by and large, people tend to agree, do not publish children. That tends to be the agreement. But even that sometimes gets encroached upon. But respect for privacy. Minimizing harm.
Okay, yeah.
That was a huge one. It makes me think about what you just talked about with Fox. Like, that's not, they're against the journalistic principles and the ethics, code of ethics, when they just decide they know they're lying and we're just going to spread this information anyway, and how you're spreading the information, the sensationalization of everything, that's also causing harm and they know it. Avoiding plagiarism. This one's huge. This one's huge. And I don't need to explain that one. It should be known that a journalism is not meant to plagiarize.
Yeah, if we've ever taken grade school English classes, everybody understands the importance of not plagiarizing.
Yeah. And the eighth is public interest. Journalists are expected to prioritize public good over anything.
It feels like the big remember your mission statement.
Correct.
The reason you're doing this in the first place.
Correct. This is what was drilled into me in my 4 years in undergrad. Mm-hmm. And I pretty much operate like that generally.
It's a good set of rules.
It's a great set of rules, I think. And I feel like by and large, the sector, the journalism sector has forgotten itself or maybe been forced out of itself. And I'll go into a bit of why, because we're here to talk about the decline of American journalism. But before we switch into the next gear, I want to talk about who can be considered a journalist, because I did mention that I don't consider TMZ to be journalism, whatever. Mm-hmm. The term journalism journalist is gray now because of our digital age, which again, we'll talk about in the second part of this topic. It's gotten so gray that everybody just thinks that journalism is something that everyone's practicing, when in reality, there are professional journalists who typically work for established news outlets and newspapers, you know, broadcast networks, things like that. And they have access to official sources. They have press events, other institutional things that they're operating under. Those are professional journalists.
Yeah.
Then there's citizen journalists. And that came about more so because of the internet. Mm-hmm. It was like, it's like citizen's arrest. Like now people have access to just say stuff. And so they can go investigate the things that they want to investigate. And then they can publish or share information. That to me is not technically journalism. I only for myself accept the first form, which is the professional journalism. And everyone else is simply a person talking. I'm simply a person talking and sharing. It's like the gossip mill or whatever.
Would you say, I want to reframe that and see if you agree with this as a simplifying it. Journalism is journalism because it follows a set of ethics and objectives, sort of the way like a scientist cares about the scientific method. Mm-hmm. But you're not a scientist just because you put a bunch of chemicals in a pot, or even you're telling people how science works. You're not a scientist unless you're devoted to the scientific method of testing and analyzing and then objectively reporting results.
Yeah.
And then even though these other things have an aspect of reporting or even an aspect of investigating, they're not journalism unless they're bought into journalism as a philosophy and a code of ethics. Is that a good way to say it?
That's how I feel about it. That's how I feel about it. There's plenty of people who do not feel that way. I think a lot of people look at underrepresented stories, right? And people who are reporting on underrepresented stories, and they're saying, well, that's not part of a larger professional journalism practice. But I think even in the underrepresented stories, and even in you investigating that and getting that out as a citizen journalist, I think that you can still abide by the code of ethics if this is something you're actually wanting to do in a way that is meant to have integrity.
Yeah.
And if you're meant to be unbiased in the telling of the underrepresented stories, but if the underrepresented stories are covered in bias, if they are not fully researched, not abiding by these eight principles that we talked about, just like what you're saying, then I don't consider that to be journalism.
Yeah.
I don't. I just consider that to be a person who found some interesting information and is sharing that. And okay.
Yeah, I think it's fair. I think also people don't differentiate enough or understand the importance of first versus secondhand reporting. Like a journalist has direct sources and direct boots on the ground in different locations. And like, you know, when I'm telling you about things on my episodes, I'm not doing journalism. I'm referencing journalists and combining that information to teach something or talk about something and dissect something, but that's not journalism.
Yeah.
The things I'm referencing are journalism.
Yeah. And there is an aspect of journalistic practice that we do take in this, the research aspect.
You for know, sure, most of those principles are still things I would believe in and agree with, even in what I'm doing, but it's not I'm not doing journalism on this podcast.
Yeah. I mean, at best, we are just a giant opinion pod.
We're a big opinion pod.
Yeah.
That's a thing Fox News doesn't get either. They're an opinion show platform.
Yeah. And again, citizen journalists can have formal journalism training. I'm a person that has formal journalism training. And you can play an important role in reporting and even providing like grassroots perspectives on things.
I think it's a really important part of the ecosystem. Like I was saying at the beginning, I find it very necessary to have this kind of middleman in my news reporting, where I have somebody who's good at interpreting it in an opinionated way.
Yeah.
I think establishment news should be as unbiased as possible, but there is huge importance to super opinionated stuff too.
Like I look at, so there's this young lady on TikTok, actually, I can't remember her name. And I'm just thinking of her as we're talking about this. She reads a lot of news media. She reads newspapers, mm-hmm. she reads magazines, she reads all kinds of stuff. And she then discusses it on TikTok. I consider her to be more of a citizen journalist, where she's mm-hmm. taking a look at this stuff and she's interpreting. She's that middle person that's like, this is interesting and here's why. And her going about the process of amassing all this, these different stories is a journalistic way of being.
Yeah.
But she herself is not doing the reporting. But I do think she's important, just like we're saying. She's important in the grassroots perspective shaping we run on, any country runs on, really. Then the other type of journalism is a freelance journalist. They're typically not, you know, hired or working for a specific news network. They can go anywhere they want. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if you're good enough, a news outlet will say, I want you to cover this. But most times it's like there's a story going and you pitch the story to the news network and they say, okay, let's run with it. And you get access to all their resources in order to make that a possibility.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So they have access in a way that citizen journalists don't necessarily have access. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's bloggers and influencers who I, without question, do not consider to be journalists. And anybody who wants to beef about it, we can go toe to toe.
I think at a large extent, it's a game of semantics and people defining the word differently.
Mm-hmm. You
know, repeating myself a little bit. Yeah, I wouldn't consider opinionated people on TikTok to be journalists. But there are also plenty of opinionated people on TikTok who I think have really good perspectives and
about,
I appreciate listening
about
to.
Things. Yeah.
And they're an important part of interpreting events, but they're not journalists. But that's not a dig.
It's not a dig.
They're a part of the thing.
Yeah.
Part of the grander perspective.
Exactly. Thank you for saying that. Because that's what I'm not saying it to say that you don't belong in the ecosystem. I do think that everybody belongs in the ecosystem, but I do think at its root, to be considered journalism, there's a code of ethics. There's a way of praxis that it should be at the root of the information that gets put out there. And I think we're at the point, and this is a good segue, I think we're at the point where the root is so rotten and hollow that it's causing every other part of the ecosystem to be similarly rotten and not producing good fruit. So that's a good segue because I want to talk about the collapse of the newspaper business model.
Ooh.
Let's talk about the collapse of the American newspaper business model, because a lot of the golden age of journalism is a result of how newspapers were built. So the business model is advertising revenue. Obviously, that's the largest source of income for most national local papers. And let's just talk about papers for now. And also classifieds were a huge revenue source that all falls under advertising. Subscription fees, whether that's a person who got a monthly subscription or a person who just bought a singular paper with the paper boys selling their paper. Get your paper. You know.
Those people. We love our newsies.
Yeah. The
newsies. Paper Brigade. Disney Channel.
Then there was syndicated content, you know, the Associated Press. Mm-hmm. So you can buy content from the Associated Press and put it into your publication, or you could sell content to the Associated Press. So all of that can be evergreen or it could be timely. You don't have to necessarily be a newspaper that has folks on staff doing that. It can be syndicated across Associated Press.
For like licensing out your firsthand.
Exactly. Reporting. Exactly. And you can sell your piece to other places as well. We used to do that in my college where we didn't always have a large group of students who were contributing. So we would pull down evergreen stories from the Associated Press, usually in like the business section or something like that. But for the bigger news items, that's where we focus most of our student reporters on. Mm-hmm. And everything else was pretty much Associated Press. So syndication is also a part of the business model, as well as, that was it. It's advertising revenue, subscription fees, and syndication. Those are the biggest sources of revenue for newspapers. Mm-hmm. Do I need to tell you that that doesn't exist anymore?
Yeah. Now, is it all advertising?
Well, it's not that it's all advertising. It's that the entire business model has collapsed. Everything was based on newspapers and we switch into the digital realm, advertising in the digital realm is cheaper than advertising in newspapers for obvious reasons. You had to print things out, you know, color, all these things go into what it costs to take up real estate on a piece of paper versus on the internet. I mean, you can get ads for pretty cheap and they can even be more targeted than what you might have gotten in the newspaper.
Yeah.
So that whole concept of advertising in a newspaper is all but gone for the most part. And that's majority of your revenue right there. Because the assumption is that if I place an ad in this paper, whatever your circulation is, like say you have 200,000 circulation, I'm maybe going to get 15% of readers. Even though your circulation is 200,000, I can't assume that 200,000 people are going to actually read it and then look at my ad. So it was very much like a hopeful advertising model if you're a business. Mm-hmm. And so with digital, you know, it pretty much destroyed that concept.
Yeah, digital can do more than just target it. It can actually give you an analytic on if it showed up on a person's screen or not.
Yeah, exactly. And how long they interacted with it. Mm-hmm. So this is the age old story of like technology ruining everything.
Mm-hmm. Classic. We should have never invented that wheel.
So that was the first like sledgehammer to the pillar, to the fourth estate, right? Is tech came along. And the problem, I guess, with tech is that it tends to move faster than people can adapt and catch up with it.
Yeah.
And so we're still seeing that to this day. Even when I was in college, we were being taught how to digitize what it is we were doing, that we needed to know how to build websites, that we needed to know how to do all of these things that would cater to the incoming digital reorganization of the press. And we were right at the beginning of it. Yay, millennials.
Yay.
And so you were no longer being taught. You were, but the remnants of being taught what it is to be in print media were slowly dissipating. You were still being taught that stuff. Again, I was an editor on the newspaper, but it was moving more toward, okay, we need to get a website for the student newspaper. We need to start doing these things because pretty soon they're not going to be picking up these papers anymore. We keep printing them and folks aren't taking them issue after issue. With the internet, people started to consume news online. And in the beginning, a lot of stuff was free because they just didn't know to do it. We're not catching up to how quickly the tech is moving. And we're not catching up to user behaviors because we're learning our own behaviors as it's evolving, right?
Right.
And then there's also the folks who don't believe that print is ever going anywhere. And I think you still have some of those people, which is interesting, but there was a huge amount of people who never imagined that print would die. Huge amount of people. Mm-hmm. And because people were getting a lot of things for free at the beginning, it created this really intense reaction to paywalls, which I think we still have. I call this the YouTube problem, where you started out giving something away because you didn't know what you had.
Yeah.
And then you want people to start paying for it. And it's like, there's this intense aversion to that concept. And then the question of why should we have to pay for news came into play. Mm-hmm. And because of all of this, again, the entire business model of journalism, of newspapers, of how we get news out generally completely changed. And I think they're still trying to find their footing. Very few places have gotten to see success in a paywall. And that means that earlier when we were talking about local newspapers and stuff that are super, super, super important to getting news out to your average person, more so than even the national and global outlets.
Yeah.
They're either gone or they just don't have the resources to do the same level of investigative journalism that they once did.
Yeah. Local news is dying, unfortunately.
Yeah. And it was the local news that did more of the hard hitting stories anyway. By the time a big story got to the national news, chances are there was some local something that did the beginnings of that. And then it became national news. So
right.
I want to back up for a second in saying that the decline in finances going toward newspapers is directly connected to the lack of investigative journalism we see today. It takes a tremendous amount of resources to do really good and thorough investigative journalism. It takes manpower. It takes research power. It takes a huge amount of money. It takes a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And that I know that we see a lot of bylines, which is the who is this article by? We see a lot of bylines that are a singular person, but it is never a singular person for a massive investigative journalism story. Mm-hmm. It is a team of people that get that done. And I need to say that because I feel like a lot of people don't know that. Though that person may be the person who got the byline and is the lead writer for it, there is a team of people behind them, providing them with the resources, kind of getting it to a certain point and say, here, run with that. Here's what I found. And that person is the person that put it together and writes it and makes it beautiful and eloquent and well put together so that it could be published. But there's an entire team, just like any other effort. There's an entire team of people who put a movie together, the same idea for a single article that makes waves. Watergate was no single journalist.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. More people got to go watch All the President's Men and realize how much of a structure is needed
yeah.
to be able to make these things happen.
I wanted to highlight the decline because I think it's important to understand how we got to what I'm going to talk about next. Mm-hmm. Whenever there is a struggling market, I think we all understand that it means that there's going to be a fire sale.
Oh, yeah. It's already making me think of what's that company that bought up all the local news stations? Are you going to get into this? There's one company.
Name a company that hasn't done that.
Well, there's the one that went viral for all of the reporters reading a script that said, I'm very concerned about the modern state of news. You know, the one where they sync them all up? Sinclair Broadcasting.
The sharing of biased and false
news has become all too common on social media.
More alarming, some media outlets.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Sinclair is not even the biggest. Mm-hmm. They're one of many. Yeah. So there's a fire sale. Anytime a sector is struggling financially, just the same as what we're experiencing now, they talk about the recession. Oh, stocks are going down. This is the time to buy, buy, buy. That's what happens in every single sector. And that's exactly what happened in journalism. So the papers are suffering. Smaller papers are acquired by conglomerates. And as with literally every single corporate acquisition, what comes after that? Layoffs, staff reductions, because now we're no longer interested in the same code of ethics and the pillars that make up our democracy. We're interested in profit now, more than we ever were before. On the 8th ethical code, the public interest is all but gone the second conglomerates get their hands on our media.
Yeah.
It becomes about profit over truth, over watchdog thought processes and news, and they begin to consolidate, cut costs at the expense of getting the truth and speaking truth to power.
And you know what's honestly too bad is I think it's degrading from both sides because news has turned into, national news has turned into entertainment. It's turned into a sport.
Mm-hmm.
And that local news is actually the things that are more directly affecting people's lives and relates more to the things people can actually have a direct change on. Mm-hmm. But it's not as sensational or entertaining.
Yeah.
And I think that's also part of the reason national news dies, is that people have disengaged with what's important around them, and they're tuning into national news because that's where all the entertainment is.
I'm glad you said that, because the next thing I was going to talk about is, with the profit over public interest comes the 24-hour news cycle.
Woo, we love it.
We don't need to have a 24-hour news cycle. We simply don't.
I said it last episode, PBS NewsHour. Every news station just be PBS NewsHour. It's on an hour a day. That's it.
They don't have that in Canada. It comes down in
really?
Certain...
They don't have 24-hour news?
Not in the same way in the U.S. They wow. have chunks, certain periods where it's like, okay, this particular period has this update, this one has this update, and this one has that update. Huh. And there's no need for a 24-hour news cycle except to just make someone more money.
Yeah.
And these are the decisions that get made when you do have a hyper-rich person at the helm of a media company, right? Mm-hmm. Is what does it mean to be in journalism, to be a journalist, to own a journalistic outlet, and not prioritize the code of ethics that journalism is meant to operate under? I shall tell you.
Okay.
Large media conglomerates, Gannett, Comcast, Disney, Viacom, Fox Corporation, New York Times, of course, the Washington Post, Google and Facebook for the newer distribution of the internet, Sinclair for TV, and there are many, many others. But if you go further down, you get to private equity firms. And once you get down to the private equity firms, you get to exactly who they're interested in politically. Is it fair to say, between you and I, is it fair to say that we trust PBS and NPR as our news sources?
In relative terms, more so than the others, but you're going to shatter my hopes and dreams, I think.
Do you know how they're able to exist?
Well, PBS is publicly funded through, well, they do have big donors. They mm-hmm. thank them at the beginning of each PBS NewsHour. I hate it. The Linda and something else foundation, you always say the beginning and I skip through that.
Yeah.
But a little bit of taxes, a little bit of donors, a little bit of billionaires. I wish I could remember the Linda and something else foundation at the beginning of every PBS NewsHour.
Uh-huh. A lot of bit of billionaires and Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I know you've heard that in almost every single PBS. Mm-hmm. So the Corporation yes. for Public Broadcasting is actually a government agency. And that's where they get the majority of their money. Why am I bringing that up? The same is true for, I mean, NPR doesn't get as much government funding. They have corporate underwriting, though, and sponsorships, grants, listeners. Mm-hmm. And we like to look at PBS and say, oh, it's publicly funded for viewers, from viewers like you.
I remember watching Sesame Street as a little kid and saying, hey, you're welcome. You're welcome, PBS. Hey. Yeah, there with my juice box going, I help pay Elmo's rent.
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
But in truth, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting helps pay Elmo's rent. And it's in danger now because we have an administration that is not interested in a free press in the way that the code of ethics demands it to be. So I want to kind of expound here a little bit and just have a little bit of dark chat, because I've always known that about PBS, but I never really thought about it in the same way until this administration, because we've mm-hmm. seen Trump's administration end what was a 70-year protocol in DC, independent journalistic access to White House events. The mm-hmm. White House Correspondents Association is what has for 70 years decided which journalists go into the journalism pool in the White House. And they've said, nope, we're giving it back to the people, which they're not. They're giving it over to their political ideology.
Yeah, they're giving it over to right-wing grifters.
Yes. And Associated Press, the Associated Press, maybe one of the most reputable, maybe one of the most trustworthy press organizations mm-hmm. in our country.
One of the least biased on the scale.
Yeah. Who actually, the AP, Associated Press, is responsible for how journalists write. They have I mean, I don't know if it's still printed, but when we were learning, you had an AP guide that told you, these are the words that get used in journalism. This is the capitalization. This is how you spell this. This is literally all of these different rules for how to write as a journalist. So when you see capital B, when you're describing Black people, when to use African American versus Black and all these different ways of writing.
Yeah.
Associated Press is responsible for that. Trump has made it so that they're not allowed in the pool until he's ready for them to be allowed in the pool.
Was it them who wouldn't say Gulf of America? Who was it that wouldn't say it and got kicked
out? I believe it was Associated Press.
I think it was Associated Press.
So the idea, again, with all of these major newspapers being owned by conglomerates, I want to just riff on how much we can expect non-biased media generally anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, what are we expecting to get out of these outlets that won't in turn only benefit the owners or the shareholders or whoever benefits financially from it? Like, how can we ever really trust that what we're given from these outlets specifically is actual good journalism?
Yeah. I mean, it's always been a sliding scale, right? Unbiased reporting is an ideal. It's an ideal. It's an objective. It's still made up of people that are telling human stories. It isn't science.
Yeah.
And you can try as much as you can to be objective, but I think you can look back at plenty of reporting from the 50s and 60s that seemed objective at the time. And then you look at to sort of the unknown bias and sort of systemic things that aren't being addressed in the mainstream and go, oh, actually, that had a little bit more bias than we would have realized at the time. So it's always been an ideal, right? But it hasn't always been as corporately owned.
Yeah.
You know, it has to some extent. You can look back, you know, I'm always dropping the movie references. There's plenty of movies criticizing journalism back in the 50s. Look at Ace in the Hole, Face in the Crowd. There's tons of movies about kind of like shady newspaper men. Yeah, it's always been an ideal. I don't want us to glamorize the past journalism as having been perfect. But I think it goes back to what you were saying earlier, that we still haven't figured out the new revenue model.
Yeah.
I mean, like for me all the time, I'll hear some story that's like a more of a local story and I'll look it up and the primary article talking about is a local paper and that's behind a paywall. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to sign up to give $12 a month to like the Oklahoma Weekly or something as a person who lives in California. But I would like to read that article and I wouldn't mind giving you money, but I can't give a monthly paywall to every news organization.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know. They still haven't figured it out. There has to be something else. But until they figure out a way to get revenue without tying yourself to corporate interests, which I don't have a whole lot of optimism for, then it's just going to get worse and worse.
I want a second. Like, yes, journalism ethics was always an ideal, but I will romanticize it a bit in saying that it was an ideal that most strove for.
Yeah.
I feel like we have more people who are wearing the badge of journalism without striving toward that code of ethics. We have more people now. And I think, and I'm going to go ahead and have a boomer take in saying that it's related to social media. It's related to everybody being able to have a voice, but without any credentials for why the voice should be heard. And I mean, that makes us no real different than the next person. We have a podcast. But I think because it's open to everyone, because the barrier to entry is so low, so are the ethics. And I think it's not something that anybody's striving for. I'm willing to bet you that most people had no idea that we had that code of ethics. Most people have no idea that there are roughly four or five organizations. Yeah, four or five organizations that have put forth this code of ethics, that they don't even know that AP, the Associated Press, is responsible for how journalism is written and how we talk about these things. And they get it wrong plenty of times and then they reissue. They've gone from, okay, we've learned more social acceptance of things, so now we're changing the way we talk about this. Like, these are important tenets and important aspects of journalism that are, that feel so lost now, and no one cares about it, including the hyper rich who own these outlets, the conglomerates that own these outlets. The idea that a private equity firm that is responsible for people's pensions owns a massive newspaper like the New York Times is wild. And I don't believe that it's something that the average person knows. They think of the New York Times and they're like going into some newspaper office and it's like a guy who's a publisher. It's like, no. The entire Chicago pension plan is wrapped up in this newspaper, which means this newspaper has to be successful so that these people don't lose their pension.
Yeah. It's a bad merger of objectives. I don't know, a bad merger of interests.
Yeah. It's nuts. Did you even think, like, when I broke it down that way, isn't that crazy? I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
And that's why I kind of wanted to pause there. Like, yeah, we're talking about PBS, NPR and stuff. And I feel like the unbiased nature of those entities is only as strong as the administration you vote in. And I know this is going in a direction that I wasn't anticipating. But when I think about that, your vote is so much more important than simply eggs or whatever it is you're pretending that it means. Mm-hmm. We're in a current administration who's interested in controlling the press, our fourth pillar of democracy, in a way that only favors him. The billionaires that benefit from him being in office are going to acquiesce to that in some way. They might not do it completely and totally so that they can maintain the facade of allowing journalism and allowing free press, but I'm going to give you an example and it's going to infuriate you probably, but you have to be living under a rock and just be completely delusional to believe that their conflict of interest in being a billionaire is not also affecting the information we're getting from these outlets.
Yeah, I mean, we learned it with William Randolph Hearst.
Yeah, literally.
He has a castle and he got to control the stories and he got to control the narratives, and he did so. He's the original Washington Post conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And he ran that town. When I visited Hearst Castle and I went to the nearby area, the history of everything was like, oh yeah, he used to own this and he used to own this. He used to have this restaurant and this. Everybody acquiesced to this one guy and he got to run the narratives. He tried to buy Citizen Kane and destroy it, not release it, you know?
I want to discuss how democracy is at stake because of all of this. And Hearst is a perfect segue into this. Did you watch Succession?
I watched the first season.
Okay. Well, it's a show that's inspired by the Murdoch family. Mm-hmm. Huge media moguls. I don't know. Do we give moguls to awful people? I don't know.
I mostly think of bad people when I hear moguls, actually.
Okay. It's inspired by the Murdoch family, and there's an entire season or a few episodes of a season dedicated to them choosing a president, like going to these Republican events and deciding on who's going to be the nominee. Mm-hmm. The family split in this decision, but in the end, they end up choosing somebody that's hyper right wing to satisfy their own desires that have nothing to do with their media company.
Yeah.
And so now the person who they want to get behind, they've given him pretty much immediate access to what kinds of material gets put out.
Mm-hmm.
Sound familiar?
Does. Sounds a little like. Or Ronald Dump.
Yeah. And so Art Imitates Life. There have been conversations. I don't know if you've seen them on social, but there have been conversations around, like, what are the warning signs that indicate that we must leave the U.S. under this administration? And the one that keeps coming up over and over and over again is attacks against the freedom of the press.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but the warning signs are all there. It's not even just the warning signs. Deciding that the White House Correspondents Association can no longer determine who's in the press pool in the White House is the biggest attack you could possibly have on freedom of the press.
And putting propagandists in there and giving them priority.
Yeah.
Marjorie Taylor Greene's dumb fuck boyfriend. He's the one who asked Zelensky why he's not wearing a suit.
Yeah.
And he keeps asking stupid questions like that. At the, I believe this was him at the car, infomercial, the Tesla infomercial they did. He said, "Mr. Trump, what was your first car?
God,
how old are you?
I just got
this is the president."
Like, my blood is bubbling just from the reenactment.
Oh my God.
But the thing is, that kind of rhetoric, I guess, that the most dangerous part about Trump since his first term was the rhetoric surrounding him. The concept of fake news, him sowing that seed of doubt in literally everything, is the most insidious part of his entire existence.
Yeah.
Because at that point, we're in hypernormalization to
Just about to say. Yeah.
And even with the people who are doing real journalism, it has now become, what is the word going around now? A cacistocracy, where the average person has their dumbass question. And for sure, there are stupid questions. We need to get back to understanding there are stupid questions.
Yeah. Hey, Mr. President, what was your first car? Is a really fucking stupid question.
And also, what are we even talking? This entire event is stupid.
Yeah.
The fact that...
Not to derail us too much.
I know, but it's just so maddening to the concept that, hey, we're going to have this whole press event. We're going to do this right in front of the White House. This is the tack... Like, America's so tacky. Like,
illegal. Can I say illegal?
Illegal.
It's more than stupid. I think it's illegal.
Oh, God. That's such an aside. I'm so angry. Anyway, that idea of question everything, believe nothing, except him... Mm-hmm. is the most insidious part of his entire existence.
Yeah.
And democracy is at stake, not just through the freedom of the press, through him being able to control it, and in a lot of ways, successfully doing so. But the reason he's successfully doing so is because the business model of news has changed and been destroyed. And thus, there was that huge land grab of what wealthy business people can now own these outlets and tailor the messaging to benefit them. So I know we've gone quite a bit, but I think about this a lot because Bezos decided, again, like I said, that he wouldn't interfere in the Washington Post since he became the owner in 2013, but that he announced that he would be changing the opinion section of the Washington Post to focus on two pillars only, personal liberties and free markets, whatever the fuck that means.
Yeah, what the fuck does that mean? What he really means is, I'm going to shift it to talk about the things that I want to talk about.
Exactly. And that's how everyone interpret it. So any viewpoints, he says this quote, any viewpoints opposing those pillars will be left to be published by others. There was a time when a newspaper, especially one that was a local monopoly, might have seen it as a service to bring to the reader's doorstep every morning in a broad-based opinion section that sought to cover all views. Today, the internet does that job. Oh my God.
Wow. I think they should change the tense in their tagline to democracy dead in darkness. Past tense.
Yeah.
It's just such an unbelievable disrespect to the entire field.
Mm-hmm.
To look at it that way.
The internet does that job. The internet.
To think that that's on par with what they're supposed to be doing.
It's on par with this administration. And he wrote an entire opinion article saying that I'm all for the free press, but we need to have other viewpoints in here. You're literally bending the knee. And as a result, it led to the departure of highly respected journalists at the Post and a scathing response from the legendary former opinions editor, Marty Baron. And after that, like 75,000 subscribers left. Yeah. But before that, Bezos also stopped the opinion section from endorsing Harris in the election just days before the endorsement was meant to be printed. And 250,000 subscribers left and even some writers joined rival publications.
Mm.
So this is... Everyone who's in the journalism field, everyone who appreciates good journalism recognizes this as an encroachment. And I want to read to you what he said, because again, he wrote an opinion piece in October where he says, you can see my wealth and business interests as a bulwark against intimidation, or you can see them as a web of conflicting interests. My own principles can tip the balance from one to the other. I just have to pause because you can see my wealth and business interests as a bulwark against intimidation, or you can see them as a web of conflicting interests.
That's the way I see it.
How about they're both? How about two things can be true?
Also, the first isn't true.
I don't think the first is true, but you believe the first is true. So how about both are true?
The first is what, like, the pathetic Elon simps say about him. He's so rich. Why would he rip us off? He already has all the money. So we can trust him because he's a billionaire. He has nothing to do with more money. So you can trust. That's unbelievably fairy tale naive horse shit. It's ridiculous. You have to be such an idiot to think that that's a reality.
If you have the stomach for it, read the entire opinion. He admits in there that his other business interests make things complicated at the Washington Post and that he's not an ideal owner.
Yeah, no shit.
Why
is he saying this out loud? Why is he writing this? He's putting this on in ink.
Yeah, it even goes so far. I want to say he mentions this, but it might be an NPR article that I'm thinking of where Amazon and Blue Origin have huge government contracts that he wants to continue. These are the conflicts of interest that he has in working with the Washington Post. And so you can never believe, you won't be able to believe any article that they have in there that criticizes him.
That's like a last episode. Anything that's criticizing him went through him and was approved by him.
Exactly.
Controlled, framed opposition.
Exactly. So I want to zero in, if this isn't already convincing listeners that this is, that democracy is at stake because of what's happening, because of these large conglomerates owning our media. I want to list some things that are happening as a result of the consolidation of media by the hyper-wealthy. The centralization of content, meaning local stories aren't at the forefront anymore. Everything is becoming about national news.
Yep.
Political ideological bias, obviously. Homogenization of content. Monopolistic landscapes. Shallow coverage. Inaccuracy. Mm-hmm. Reduced accountability. Erosion of journalistic integrity. Those are just a few of the things that have gone horribly awry at the hands of the super wealthy owning our news outlets. I'm going to read this because I actually wrote this down because I was so angry. Not only is democracy at stake, but as we're watching government agencies be gutted left and right, our most trusted outlets are also at stake. We have a president with a penchant for revenge, so he sues conglomerates like CBS for $10 billion, claiming defamation. And he's coming after Voices of America and any agency that funds news and entertainment outlets. Washington Post slogan, once again, is democracy dies in darkness. Turns out it dies in a money pit.
Yeah, damn.
It dies even in worse, a money pit.
Even worse with him suing outlets. There, do you remember who it was? If some media company he recently sued in a really bullshit lawsuit that he easily would have lost. But they settled.
I think it was ABC. I think it was ABC.
Mm-hmm. They gave him like millions of dollars. And it was seen as them just funneling money towards him.
Yeah.
It was like them bending the knee and just giving him money.
Yeah.
If they had gone to court, they would have won.
Mm-hmm.
Easily. But they'd rather just say, hey, you're the one in control now. We're sorry. Here's some money.
Yeah. And it's not going to stop. It's going to keep going until he bleeds them dry. If he can, if they don't stand up against it. But do we have faith that the hyper wealthy are going to stand up against this administration? I don't think we can have that kind of faith. They benefit too much from him being there. It's literally that season in Succession, where they chose the hyper right wing person that they knew was terrible for America. Even one of the kids in Succession's daughters was accosted or attacked, harassed on the street because she was not white. And he loses his mind, but he still backs the right wing candidate because it would just be better for the company.
It's also just say these people that are cannibalizing the nation, you're making a shittier country to live in. Like, they're living in this world where, like, everywhere J.D. Vance goes, he's booed right now.
But he has a stupid smirk on his face when he has it, when they're booing.
Troll piece of shit. I was wishing in that video of him being booed at the
Kennedy Center.
At the Kennedy Center, I was like, I wish everybody walked out. Everybody should have walked out.
He wouldn't have given a shit.
I don't know. I didn't find that video as cool as everybody else. It was like, somebody throw a fucking shoe.
Throw your fucking shoe.
He's not that far away. You can hit him with a shoe.
You can hit him with a shoe.
If you go to jail, it'd be worth it.
We're not mad enough. We're not angry enough.
I can't wait for the opportunity to hit him with a shoe. Remember when Donald Trump flew past my bedroom window?
Yeah. Dang it.
Unfortunately, I have a screen. I have a screen in the way. I have to pop it out, get my shoe off, throw it in the rotor blades.
Yeah, you'd be the hero.
Yeah.
We'd send you to Cuba. They'd never find you.
Nah, but it'd be worth it.
It'd be worth it. Anyway, that was a lot of doom. I hate it. Looking into this from a who owns our media perspective, which is what this is about. This episode is about the American journalism decline, or the decline in American journalism, and how we got here, how we got to the point where the hyper rich own our media outlets. I know I don't want to romanticize too much of how amazing journalism used to be, because there was always been bad actors, right? But how we dealt with those bad actors is entirely different. And whenever a publisher would come into the newspaper, and the publishers and editors used to fight all the time, because the second a publisher came in to say, you can't do this X, Y, Z, fisticuffs. Okay? Fisticuffs. Because if the editor said, absolutely not, this is what we're doing and this is why we're doing it, chances are the editor was going to win, or he was willing to be fired for it.
Yeah. I mean, like we were saying earlier, the problem is that it's degrading on both sides. Like, audiences don't care or want that objective reporting, or not even really aware that they should be wanting that reporting. Because, like we brought up several times, William Randolph Hearst, he was Jeff Bezos.
Yeah.
He owned a giant newspaper, dictated the stories for his own corporate interests. And that's like the beginning of newspapers. So it's not, oh, this is kind of a pun, but it's not black and white, you know?
Oh. Yeah, but maybe it's a chicken and egg thing, which what degraded first? I feel like the press degraded first, or the press got in the hands of people who were willing to degrade it. And then that in turn shaped the reader.
Yeah, it's definitely, to reuse something we said last episode, a little bit of a yes anding. You know,
yes ending.
Newspaper said, hey, what if we got a little slimier and people react to it? And then audiences said, yes, please. This is getting wound up.
But it's literally capitalism. You know, you, Andrew, had a paper at the end of the block, and I want to get into the papers. And so I'm working with you, but I don't like how you doing things. So I want to start another paper, and I got to do it a different way in order to outsell your paper. But you're taking all the paper routes. Mm-hmm. I got to figure out how to get around it. So then I become sensationalized. I get a little boy on the street saying, woman hit in the head with a bat. Get your paper.
Yeah.
Even though there's no story about a woman getting hit in the head, but he's already taken the penny and he's run away now.
Yeah.
So like, there's always been bad actors, but it truly is capitalism.
It's the bad guy in every episode.
Yeah.
M. Night Shyamalan did not write this podcast. The twist is the same every time. And you always see it coming.
Who are the writers of Scooby-Doo? Because that's who wrote this podcast.
Yeah, Hanna-Barbera wrote this.
There you go. Anyway, in the next part of this episode, I want to talk about the digital landscape of journalism and what that has done to create doom in our world. But I think this was a good backdrop of how we even got here. Yeah. And what the digital space is basically tacking on to the doom in this world. But I asked myself when I was going through all this, like, my goodness, is there any hope?
Do you know the answer?
No, I'm throwing it out.
Is it? Oh.
I literally wrote, I don't know, man.
Yeah, I think the answer is no, but maybe.
Maybe, I don't know.
Oh, why not? It makes me feel better to say maybe.
So the only thing that I came up with is that there is a such thing as nonprofit journalism, where small outlets, local outlets, are held up by literally the people. They don't get any government funding. They don't get anything like that. They're held up by people who are willing to pay for their news outlet to cover things. Those things do exist. There's not very many of them. Mm-hmm. And the chances of them getting national traction are fairly small, but that's the only tiny glimmer of hope that I think exists, is that there are people out there who are putting their money toward real news. And I think until we can figure out what the actual business model needs to look like, the only other thing I can think of is you got to keep it simple. Like it all goes back to capitalism. The reason why this is a problem is because everybody thinks we have to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And now that these news outlets are attached to shareholders and are publicly traded, they have to keep getting bigger because people expect returns year over year over year. And so what happens if you say, this isn't about growth? Not everything is about growth.
Yeah.
If it's just about serving the public interest, then it shouldn't be attached to any financial growth. It should simply be about getting the truth out and holding up that final pillar of free press and making sure all the other pillars are functioning the way they should be for the people.
Yeah, thinking of it as one of those pillars, it needs to be a business only due to its necessity to be private and separated from other interests, but it's also in conflict with its objectives. You know, money ruins everything. So I guess you think the only word of advice is to put your money where your mouth is and support the things you support with your money.
I think so. And I think it goes back to what you said earlier, which is something that I've always done. And I think everybody has to do, which is to diversify as much as you can, the outlets that you consume. If you notice that when reporting is happening, you're feeling anxious and on edge about things, chances are that's being sensationalized. I think we all have to do a little bit more work to pay attention to how we feel when we're ingesting news.
Yeah.
We are overrun and overstimulated by sensationalized news. We just are. Mm-hmm. When you go to other countries, like, you get the news and it's just given to you very calmly. Like, these are just the facts. When I listen to PBS NewsHour, I don't feel riled up. I don't feel on edge.
Yeah, it's boring, which is what it should be.
Yeah, but it's informative and you're paying attention and it's good. Yeah. And I think if you find yourself listening to something and you're like getting into it the way you would a movie or a sports ball game.
Yeah.
Then that's bad. You're actually not receiving journalism at this point, at least not good journalism. Mm-hmm. You're receiving a biased opinion of how to interpret what they're saying. It's no different than like a preacher at a pulpit. There's the words in the book and then there's the way it's being delivered.
Yeah,
Try to get to the words in the book. I mean, I'm not advocating for anyone to read any religious text whatsoever. I'm just giving it as an analogy.
This is just a lighthearted sponsor of this episode, the Lutheran Church.
Oh, gosh. Brought to you by King James Bible. I think that's what I pay attention to now more than ever, is how do I feel when I'm watching this? I pretty much had to stop watching CNN.
Oh, yeah. I don't actually watch cable news at all.
Yeah.
At all. I do look at CNN's like homepage and stuff, and it's not a great source really, but it's one of my sources that I use in my media diet.
Yeah.
But I think TV news almost shouldn't exist. I think it's just so, it lends itself so much to needing to be entertaining in a way that print journalism doesn't necessarily suffer from as much. People don't expect that as much from print journalism.
Yeah.
Where keeping people watching is just baked into how they make money on the 24-hour cable news cycle.
So, the most sensationalizing you get in print media is a very catchy headline, which takes an entire department to come up with. and then whatever photo you use.
Can I tell you what was a radicalizing moment for me with cable news? Was during the first Trump administration, someone put some tax information, Rachel Maddow's mailbox. Do you remember mm-hmm. this thing? And then she did this big thing. I've got Trump's tax returns tonight. We're going to go through them. And it was, she made it like this big spectacle. And she did like an hour and a half broadcast where she just kept teasing and teasing and teasing and teasing. And then at the very end, she gets into it and it's like nothing.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, that was a wake up call for me to be like, oh, this is all horse shit. This is mm-hmm. all entertainment.
Yeah. Yeah. There is entertainment journalism, but the actual news about real topics, politics, and things like that should not be included in entertainment journalism.
No. And I think it doesn't always come from a bad point of view. I think some, I mean, Rachel Maddow should be ashamed of that broadcast, but mm-hmm. I think a lot of the time it's unconscious. It's just like, this is the way we talk and engage as a host. And you kind of get into this thing that you kind of forget about the boring, dry, you know, Walter Cronkite style reporting.
Yeah. But that's why you have to always harken back to the code of ethics, because is the way you're delivering this for the good of the people? Mm-hmm. Or is it your bias that's showing?
Yeah. I think people just need to revisit that visit it for the first time. And reset. We've forgotten what news is supposed to be.
Yeah. And to be fair, they would not have a show if they did it the way that many other countries do it.
Yeah.
Even our sports coverage, when I watch American sports games, we're so much more dramatic than every other
I don't know.
I've
seen soccer.
Yeah, soccer gets dramatic. Soccer does get dramatic. But if you ever get the chance, watch multiple countries' coverage of the Olympics.
Okay.
Because that's where you see it the absolute most.
Like, you know, I always think this about, you ever watch Ninja Warrior and then American Ninja Warrior? That's sports, as far as I'm concerned.
I didn't even know there was anything other than American Ninja Warrior.
Really?
Yeah.
Way before American Ninja Warrior, there was the original, American Ninja Warrior is an American adaptation of Japanese show. And the announcer on that show is 100,000 times better than the American ones. American ones are like, oh, look, he's going for it. Oh, good job. But in the original Ninja Warrior, they're like, he's a fireman and this is his moment to shine.
Wow.
He's going up the warp wall. He did it. Of course, not in English, but it's so dramatic, and they like, it's like soap opera storylines with all of these mm-hmm. recurring people that come to compete, and they're just like screaming and shouting and enthusiastic. It's so much better.
Well, maybe it's about whatever actually interests the country. They get excited about that. But when I look at the Olympic news coverage, I'm like, oh my goodness, I need an American coverage because this is so boring. Yeah.
Which also I think is a great recommendation to readers. Something I do, and I need to do a little bit more. Look out foreign coverage of America.
Yes.
BBC coverage of American politics is great. It's actually probably better than any American coverage mm-hmm. of American politics.
Canadian coverage is actually really good too.
Oh, that's a good point.
Because it's very just like, this is what it is. This is what's happening.
Yeah.
Occasionally they'll have a segment where they'll riff on opinions with each other, but for the most part it's just like, this is what's happened, this has never been done before. And I think the reason for that, and it's probably true even if we did coverage of other people's country, but why would America ever do that? I think the reason is because they're teaching people about America at the same time as they're covering this particular news item, so it being sensationalized doesn't really have a place that when mm-hmm. they have to meet their audience at a certain place.
If part of the appeal of foreign coverage is that they don't have the same kind of skin in the game. Canada's got some skin in the game, unfortunately, now.
Canada does have some skin in the game, but they're still very, very unbiased about it.
Yeah.
The BBC, yes, but they're also a little...
BBC's got some bad history, and they're not... You know what? No. Yeah. But...
The point is diversify your sources.
The point is diversify. No place is perfect, you know?
Yeah, no, but I do think the feeling aspect has, we got to pay attention to how we feel when we're ingesting the news. Because if you're feeling too many like intense feelings, anxiety and all that stuff, it's probably bad journalism. It's probably bad. It's probably a lot of opinion in how you're receiving that information. So I think pay attention to that kind of thing quite a bit. I don't know, aside from the smaller, like I said, nonprofit journalism examples, it does feel, I don't know that there's any hope outside of that. It does feel really good that people are putting their money where their mouth is and supporting those nonprofit outlets. But I am increasingly concerned that the hyper wealthy have more and more control over shaping the very culture of the country. Mm-hmm. In ways that aren't really being perceived the way I think they need to be perceived. When you take away local news or the investigative aspect of local news, when you put everything in the hands of social media or the internet, like Bezos is saying the internet does that job, you don't have a view of the actual diversity of the country in a very huge way. It becomes very monolithic. It becomes very, again, centralized. All the things that I've listed as to why these mega corporations owning our news outlets is a huge threat to democracy. In a country that has as much diversity as America does, it's not going to look like that in the hands of this these centralized outlets. It's just not. It's going to favor whatever they want to happen. He himself has said he's not an ideal owner. He himself talks about his own conflicts of interest in owning the Washington Post and yet having these massive government contracts. Mm-hmm. He sat behind, or I guess in the front row behind him at the inauguration.
They sat these closer than Trump's family members.
Yeah, these are all massive conflicts of interest. And in the next installment of us diving into journalism, we'll talk about the Googles and the Facebooks that are, those two are almost solely responsible for how news gets disseminated on the internet.
Well, I'm excited for next episode.
Solely responsible. And every bit of flack that Zuckerberg has gotten about what he is or is not doing with Facebook, he deserves it tenfold. Mm-hmm. Tenfold. He's not getting enough, actually.
Yeah.
He's not getting enough. So between Google and Facebook, they are responsible for what culture gets pushed around and how.
Yeah.
So we'll go into that in part two, but I just want to leave this episode on the decline of American journalism with the following statement. Billionaires are the scourge of the earth. And with that, I say, make sure you rate and follow Happy Doomsday everywhere you get podcasts. Follow Happy Doomsday Pod on all socials except Twitter. And until next time, Happy Doomsday.
Happy Doomsday.
I love Tesla.